back to the popular show. You can't say anything anymore. You can hear. In fact, you have to. David Slavik, can I say happy Thanksgiving to you?
Yes, it's a beautiful day. Just we're post-Thanksgiving. We're at Black Friday, where, you know, communists go to be consumerist because you got to get that TV. I am here in lovely Newfoundland, one of the first and last colonies of the British Empire, and I'm very lucky to be talking to Joe Guinan, who is a citizen of both one of the last and first British colonies as well.
That's right. You're coming to us from Washington, D.C., Joe Guinan.
That's right. Yes. Happy Thanksgiving. As we were just saying, a reminder that the genocidal violence is part of the nature of the world system and has been for a long time and unfortunately is still with us today.
Joe is one of the great backdoor men of 21st century socialism. His latest book is The Case for Community Wealth Building, co-written with Martin O'Neill. I've got that here. He's the president of Democracy Collaborative, a think tank based in DC. He was one of the secret architects of the best parts of the Corbyn program. And from Cleveland to Preston, he's still hard at work bringing the collective ownership of the means of production to the people as best he can. And this is, I think, maybe the fourth time you've been on the popular show. So it's really great to see you again, even if every time we do have you on, things seem to have got a little bit worse.
Well, absolutely. I think that you can measure the decline in the periods, and it's good to be reminded of all the work that we have to do. Thanks for that generous introduction. It's the collective work of many hands, and I'm privileged to work with many great people on all of that.
And once again, I want to insist that people understand that correlation is not causation.
Yeah, things aren't getting worse because you keep appearing on the popular show, nor are they getting worse because we keep doing the popular show. Incidentally, David, it's Thanksgiving. That means that next week we will have been doing this for 3 years.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, you know, in this time we've had many great guests, kind of ridden the edge and a bit ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. Much to the chagrin of some of our more normie friends.
That's right. But the backstabbers, the fake bitches, and the fake friends will be glad to know that we're going to be continuing 3 more years at least.
Absolutely.
If you want to help us out, patreon.com/thepopularpod. Let me say that again. patreon.com/thepopularpod. It's not a Black Friday thing. Everything we've been recording, and it's been a lot this month, is too important to be locked. It's all out there for free, but we're kind of value for value. At the moment, if you're deriving value from this podcast and platform, please consider helping us out over there. You get complete video of all our episodes. You get some of the other interviews I've been doing elsewhere, all in one place, as well as some first drafts of some of the writings that I've been doing, but mainly it's just to help keep us fighting the good fight. That's what we're trying to do. And that's what we're doing with Joe Guinan. So we've got a whole world to cover, really, with Joe, but let's start parochial. Let's start small. You've been covering for Novara Media some very interesting news about Britain that appeared in the Sunday Times, appeared on Novara. Haven't really heard too much of it elsewhere. A bit more of it, more of this story has been made of in the States, where Matt Taibbi has been promoting it. So I'm just going to drop in a clip from Matt to see how it's being spoken about over your side.
Matt Taibbi has released what he calls the UK files, exposing Britain's Labour Party's expansive efforts to thwart groupthink, or what they deem disinformation. These internal documents that he dug through revealed the party has attempted to censor both the right and the left equally. They've set their sight on Glenn Greenwald, Michael Schellenberger, even my co-host, Brianna Joy Gray over here.
Not me.
What they show is really the whole history of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, whose CEO is a guy named Imran Ahmed. And what's crucial, I think the key point that comes out in these early releases is that this group its origins come from a faction of the Labour Party, and it was dreamed up while Ahmed was working for the Labour Party. So this idea that it's an independent operation, it really doesn't hold water. It's a Labour Party operation, particularly one faction tied to a thing called Labour Together. And they started with a pair of episodes in like around 2015 and 2017, involving one Tory politician and then one Corbynite group. They're going after anybody. I think this has been a major misperception of this whole issue among people who are kind of the center left disposition. They think, oh, well, this is just going after people who are right wing belligerents or anti-vaxxers or some other kind of socially unacceptable person. Really, that's not true. They're going after anybody who is politically outside, the very narrow mainstream. And that can include Jeremy Corbyn. It can include you. It can definitely include Bernie Sanders. But the consistent strategy with every single one of these groups is to label everybody a bigot, intolerant, or supportive of violence, or of threatening behavior,
and
then just sort of go from there. Right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So we've got these two groups emerging kind of close together, a lot of shared personnel. On the one hand, Labour Together, a group trying to make the Labour Party electable. What's wrong with togetherness? Who could object to being electable? On the other hand, the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, which tries to get hate off of the internet. Who could be for hate? Surely, Joe Guinan, we should be happy that people are out there trying to get rid of hate and promote togetherness. What do we need to know about these two interlinked organizations?
Well, I think the old political nostrum that if you want to see if anyone's actually saying something, invert the meaning of what they're saying and see if that's something that could possibly be argued. And I think that we all smell a rat when we see such blandishments. And in fact, what we've started to see is the contours of that rat beginning to emerge. Personally, I've been waiting for some time for the I would say inevitable emergence of at least some of the backstory of the last 5 years in British politics to come out. And sometimes these things find their way out in strange ways. I'm reminded of the attack on Libya and the destruction that occurred. And among the rubble was found some documentation that actually then opened up the connections all the way back to the black ops programs of the CIA and the involvement of Jack Straw and the cases that emerged out of that. So I think what we're seeing now in a roundabout way is the emergence of some of the story of what's actually happened in Labour politics in the last while. And it's pretty interesting as we start to pull at that thread. Yes, it's coming out of this work to look at hate generally and freedom of speech issues and look at who the actors are engaged in that. But almost as a footnote, what we've got is this Sunday Times story, which was just published by Gabriel Pogrund and Harry York, which essentially highlights how, according to the Sunday Times account and the background research that was done by Paul Holden, who's an investigative journalist who has a book coming out next year, The Fraud, Keir Starmer, Labour Together and the Crisis of British Democracy, from Orr Books, which just happens to be my publisher, of People Get Ready. And so what we're learning is that Labour Together played a pretty significant role in essentially levering Keir Starmer into power in the Labour Party on what I would argue are entirely false pretenses, as a means of putting Corbynism back in its box and liquidating the left and making the Labour Party safe for the British state and the interests of capital. And the way in which this was done is detailed through following the money, the old Watergate adage. So what we found from this story is that £730,000 in donations from a slew of millionaire businessmen were either misreported or entirely underreported by Labour Together, and that this was then used to finance a program of research, of opinion polling, which is expensive, to really figure out something that I think they were quite clever to put their finger on, which was that there was a soft underside to the Labour Party membership.
Could you say that figure again? Because just for American listeners, you know, these figures, this is a big figure in British politics. This is not sort of changed down the back of the couch. This is an amazing figure to have forgotten to acknowledge and to report, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know this might seem chicken feed in an American context, but actually you're talking not just about political spending in elections, but political spending in essentially the election of leadership within the Labour Party. And this figure dwarfs all previous spending that has occurred as part of leadership contests among the membership of the Labour Party. So we're talking about essentially £750,000, which is way beyond anything that we could have expected. And the fact that it was deliberately underreported, I think, is part of the story of putting the finger on how this was a deliberate operation.
And I think for some of our American and Canadian listeners, and I straddle that standpoint epistemology, I would say that what they don't understand, this at the same time, this is when they are cutting field organizers, some of their outreach work, some of the stuff that was really necessary and part of the Corbyn program to build the party bigger and broaden the party to include lots of people who felt underrepresented and then ultimately either fell out of politics or became, you know, Tories.
Look, Pogrund and York are not leftist agitators. They're Murdoch journalists for the Sunday Times. And how they characterize this is, I quote, money at a scale rarely seen in Labour politics, and it's already changed the party's future, setting Starmer on the path to Downing Street. So it's a very important amount of money. And what the Sunday Times story revealed was that there was a total of something like 20 separate breaches of electoral law involving Labour Together over a period for which the organization was just unable to provide a reasonable excuse, according to the Electoral Commission. And at the helm of Labour Together at this time was Morgan McSweeney, who is probably not known to your listeners. Talk about backdoor men. This is a hatchet man of the Labour right who's risen through local government politics and the networks of the Labour right to take the helm of this organization, to underreport and undeclare what was actually being raised and funneled into, basically identifying the platform that Starmer needed to run upon in order to appeal to the center of gravity of the party. So let's just be clear about that, right? At the time, there'd just been a catastrophic setback for the Labour right because Corbyn had, against all odds, taken the leadership of the Labour Party. The 2017 general election result had deprived Theresa May of her parliamentary majority, despite being an election that was unnecessary, a voluntary election called to essentially wipe Labour out and give May the majority she needed to push through her version of Brexit. Instead, we got the biggest turnaround in polls that pollsters have ever seen when the Labour Party manifesto under Corbyn came out. And so the Labour right in these circumstances were in a very difficult spot. And I think they did a very clever thing, which is something that we ought to learn from on the left, which is they identified the soft underbelly of the Corbyn surge in matters of political education and ideology. And what they found was something that I think has been evident from a lot of decent reporting and instances where we've actually been able to see the Corbyn membership on display, which is that a lot of it was made up of just decent, well-meaning grandmothers and kids that flocked to basically a program of essentially basic needs and reforming British capitalism. And this was just utterly unacceptable to the status quo. The Labour right had been deprived of their sinecures and their positions. And so what they did was craft a platform that was designed to appeal to a majority of the party membership who just suffered a catastrophic general election defeat in 2019. And this is where we get the origins of Starmer's 10 pledges and the platform that he set out, which has since been basically thoroughly repudiated by Starmer. So Starmer was a front man for a smash and grab raid, essentially a confidence trick that was played upon the Labour Party membership on a basis of pledges that have now been repudiated, false pretenses that allowed the right to seize control of the Labour Party. And since then, they've been systematically liquidating the Corbyn project, including removing the party whip from Corbyn in Parliament, but also stitching up selections, driving out vast numbers of party members, in part by expelling a number of them, including many left-wing Jews on the grounds of anti-Semitism, which is another rat that we really ought to have smelled earlier, and so forth. So this is the beginning, I think, of the story coming out of how that was enacted. It's very important that it's come out now in the Sunday Times rather than, alas, on the fringes of media and political debate.
I just want to pull one thing out, and then I'll let you, James, I'll let you talk. But one thing I think that you got at, and I don't think that is being hammered home enough, is the fact that this was violent and impolite. And I think the sort of Starmer wing of the party wants to say the Corbynistas, bad. They're rough. These are rough and tumble people who act in rough and tumble ways. They're not good in a boardroom, you know, and you know, they probably do weird stuff in the bedroom. You know, it's just one of those like things where it's just like, these are impolite, incorrect people. But the way this went about was actually way out of order of the way the party is operated and really how politics operate in the US and in the UK.
It's pure thuggery. And the claim can be made that Starmer's victory was bought. I mean, unless they didn't really have to buy it because as Joe's described, the average Labour member is a nice person who wants a nice man in charge. And Jeremy Corbyn seems to be a nice man. Ed Miliband seems to be a nice man. And Keir Starmer seems to be a nice man, even though he absolutely is not. So Labour together got their man in. They got Starmer into the leadership immediately. Morgan McSweeney, the leader, was made Starmer's chief of staff, dropped a little bit later in one of the low points of Starmer's polling. And that moment early in 2020 was also when the Centre for Countering Digital Hate really swung into action. And its early targets were David Icke, the prolific conspiracy theorist. And after all, who could oppose a group that's merely trying to deplatform David Icke, who we all agree is this terrible crank? And then they went for Katie Hopkins and George Galloway, the sort of the pariah left and the pariah right. Again, you know, God bless George, but people weren't really swinging in to defend these folk. And then you realize that these targets, which no one is going to object to being made, actually the whole kind of playbook is deeply connected to the hit job that was done on Corbyn himself. In fact, Rachel Riley, a daytime TV presenter who was sort of an example of somebody who was quite visibly radicalized against the left online during the Corbyn years, she became the face of this project. And after those early scalps and targets, the Centre for Countering Digital Hate sort of started to turn its attention to the left in general and also to dissenting voices on COVID. And our listeners, and I'm sure you, Joe, have a variety of opinions on that. But where I think that Matt Taibbi is quite right, and an argument we've been making all along, is that the wrong people were empowered to decide what we were and weren't allowed to hear and know about COVID. And it just sets the most appalling precedent for how crises are going to be handled in the future. And it's probably not too much to say that it permanently changed the internet itself. It brought it in-house as an arm of the security state in a way that it hadn't been to that extent before. So really, we've got a sort of picture where the Corbyn trauma that we were so embroiled in, Joe, actually became a sort of a paradigm or a starting point for ways of controlling dissent, ways of delegitimizing rivals and enemies, and ways of getting away with a hell of a lot that we're continuing to see play out in different areas of culture, politics, and life.
Yeah, and that prompts a thought that is a very disconcerting one that I'm going to have to chew on. But I think it's often argued against the agro-centrists that they are in some ways adopting the frames and methods of the far right and dragging the Overton window to the right. What I think even more disconcertingly we may have to grapple with is that actually the methodology and approach to the next generation of repression and social control and censorship is actually pioneered by the agro-centrists and then is something that can then be adopted and spread by far-right networks and others. And in some ways, you see this even with the very basic move that was at the heart of the third way, which was triangulation. Which was essentially a dishonest mechanism by which you differentiate yourself not only from your political opponents, as they're supposed to be on the right, but also from your own base as a way of stitching together that sort of temporary consent that then allows you to come in and essentially consolidate and do all the things that we know that the third way did rather than challenge Thatcherism and neoliberalism. And so I think some very dark and disturbing things have been happening in the political center in the last few years that we essentially let them off the hook for by blaming them for adopting methodologies and approaches from the right, whereas actually they're initiating them, which I need to think more about that and what some of the implications of that are.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we're seeing the political importance of the concept of harm play out in the struggle over meaning in the mediatization of Israel's assault on Gaza right now, this absolutely astonishing doublethink that we're all expected to subscribe to, where symbolic violence and people's perception that they're being threatened is more important than actual bloodshed that we're all seeing play out in a totally new way in front of our eyes in Gaza. So if somebody says that they're intimidated by a peace march, or more likely somebody says that someone else is going to be, no one's saying I am intimidated by the peace march. People are saying it by the hate march. People are saying someone else is. It's always this kind of gesture on behalf of this threatened group.
Eggshell identitarians.
Exactly. we're seeing it sort of ran down our throats once again. And sure enough, here was Rachel Reeves a few days ago talking about how dangerous and threatening it is that the Green Party published a list of MPs who voted against a ceasefire, and how dangerous and threatening it is that protests are going on outside MPs' offices.
Last week we saw the office of the Labour MP, Roshanara Ali, pretty much besieged by pro-Palestinian protesters, saw something similar at Keir Starmer's own constituency office. Is this a reasonable exercise of free expression, or is this becoming old-fashioned bullying?
I believe in the right to protest. I don't believe in the right to intimidate. And some of those protests, I believe, over the last few days, have crossed the line from protest to intimidation. Protesting outside people's homes, putting pressure on them in that way, I think it's totally unacceptable. In a democracy, we elect our MPs and they make decisions. They represent their constituents, but they also listen to all of the evidence. And anything that would attempt to intimidate an MP to vote in a certain way or to put pressure on them, it is anti-democratic.
So there is the shadow chancellor who is Sorry. Extremely worried about people trying to influence MPs to vote a certain way.
I like that. I mean, it's probably good that we're outlawing lobbyists under their rubric. You know, I mean, as someone who's done plenty of it in my life, I think it's quite funny. But that's the whole point of democracy, is to influence people to do what you want. And this, and I think this is an American elite problem, and it's also a British elite problem, that it's they are getting very uppity about the idea that they have to represent anything their people want, anything. And, you know, we saw this in, you know, with Trump, we see it, you know, now with Joe Biden, they say, well, do you want Trump to be president? Do you want a fascist president? You're like, no, man, I just, you know, want some basic stuff. That's all. And you see this in the British context as well. They're like, you know, yeah, I know you love Jeremy Corbyn, but listen, we can get this normal guy in here. And you know, we got these weirdos over here. I mean, it's just like it's getting to the point where it's just like, trust us. I don't trust you. And that's basically the equation.
Joe, you were behind the scenes in the Labour Party facing off against these people. They're hard bastards. What are they doing going on TV pretending they're scared?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. These are some of the nastiest political operators, bar none, in British political life. And it's just, it makes my blood boil to listen to and watch in real time the gaslighting and the cynical moves that are involved in things like what Rachel Reeves just said in that clip. And I think, James, you're absolutely right about this issue of paradigm and about the paradigm that's being created. So what did Rachel Reeves say there? We all believe in the right to protest, but... Well, what she then went on to do was basically characterize in a trope, since this is part of their terminology, that is a longstanding one of liberals with regard to democracy, which is the fear of the great unwashed mob out there, intimidating, bullying, with the implications of violence, what was essentially a political protest, bringing heat outside the office of an MP who had just abstained rather than voted to call for a ceasefire in, you know, the graphically horrific situation we've seen unfolding in Palestine. And so it could hardly be an issue of higher stakes in terms of life and death, of genocide, of the rules-based international order, which is something that they like to genuflect towards, which we could talk about if you like. But the cynicism involved in this, and you know, again, going back to the Sunday Times piece, I know this seems like a storm in a teacup, but I think that issue of pinpointing the methodology and establishing what paradigm is operating here is a really important one. The basic premise of Starmerism was lying as political strategy, setting out a whole set of things that people were pledged would be delivered by a Starmer leadership, and then doing a complete vault fast, but doing so in such a brazen way that that you are lied to despite the evidence of your eyes and ears, to quote Orwell in 1984, right? And so all of us heard Keir Starmer say that Israel had the right to cut off water, food, and power as part of their self-defense, albeit with, again, this sneaky rider in compliance with international law. Well, you don't have a right to conduct a massacre in compliance with international law, because there's no such thing. Similarly, there's no such thing as collective punishment as being incompatible with international law. And yet they brazenly lay this out. And it's actually part of how they're conducting policy as a whole now. So, you know, in the same way that we believe in the right to protest, but we hear... we don't believe in trickle-down economics, but, and then the entire agenda is trickle-down economics. And so this new sort of model of lying about the headline up front and then doing this sort of fancy footwork underneath that essentially allows them to exculpate themselves. Of course, we're not doing trickle-down economics. Of course, we're not against breaches of international law regarding collective punishment, but then going on to adopt the policy posture and position that allows that. Again, storm in a teacup, but one of the stories that Paul Holden and Matt Taibbi have focused on so far, and I think there's a lot more to come, was so-called Britgate, which yes. I'm almost embarrassed to bring up, David, for American listeners. But this was essentially the story of a brick that was supposedly thrown through the window of the constituency office of a centrist Labour MP, Angela Eagle, in a part of the country that is a solid Labour heartland, with the implication that this was done by exactly that hoi polloi, rough and tumble, Corbynista, great unwashed mob that we're all supposed to be in fear of that threatens democracy. It turns out that behind the manipulation of the story of Britgate was exactly the same person who was behind the creation for the Center for Combating Digital Hate and the methodology that's then been deployed by Labour Together. So again, you pull at the thread, you're beginning to get the paradigm. We know from political science and other disciplines that intervening at the level of the paradigm is actually where we need to go next. We need to make clear how this operates, how it's done, so that as it's being done to people in real time, they can spot the trick. We believe in the right to protest, but we are against trickle-down economics, but and everything that flows from that as a cynical manipulation.
There was something that happened in Canada just recently. There was alleged that the social justice and peace activism group at the University of British Columbia had put up "I love Hamas" stickers. Which is, like, on its face is pretty hilarious. Like, it's simply not the point of view of 99% of people who are supportive of the Palestinian cause, and even of liberal Zionists who are looking for ceasefire. You know, and I know that just from my personal network.
Those stickers are available on the £10 tier, patreon.com/thepopularpod, incidentally.
So it was mentioned at the time that this seemed out of the ordinary because it would be helpful, right? And I think one thing that we've seen in this particular instance, and I think in Labour during that time, is that they're actually very concerned about optics, right? They were going to throw a brick. They're like, hey, we're getting somewhere. We're not going to throw that brick. And of course, this stuff comes out later. But if you're on, you know, Sky News or something like that, you're getting interviewed, they'll say, those brick throwers over there, and there's no time to respond. And it becomes part of this wisdom, you know, like, you know, these type of people who put "I love Hamas" up didn't do it. Not that wasn't their fault. In fact, it was a direct attack at their political project, but still they carry that weight with them. How do we deal with that, Joe?
And by the way, let's just make clear, there was no brick, right?
There wasn't even a brick.
a window was broken, but it wasn't in Angela Eagle's building. It was in the stairwell of a shared office space. And there was no evidence of any political connection, not even evidence of a brick.
Yeah. There was, I heard it was an empty wine bottle and someone just opened the window and it fell off and smashed.
Yeah. It was probably one of those Novara media people drinking champagne and they fell.
It is embarrassing, you know, to talk about Britgate.
It was Grace Blakely. Friend of the show. We love Grace.
It is embarrassing to talk about Britgate, but in a way it's necessary because all this Corbyn history is increasingly being forgotten. You know, the younger leftists, people who got involved in 2017 even, and after, they don't know that, like, pre-2017 stuff. I'm sort of starting to realize this. And as kind of banal as the work is, we do need to remember these incidents. We do need to remember that it's exactly the same people pulling exactly the same stunts, because they sure as hell haven't forgotten that it worked the first time around. The Britgate is just being kind of repeated again by the same people. Angela Eagle herself was complaining about those thuggish protesters at the same time that Reeves was, at the same time as Keir Starmer was saying that he's worried for his family with these protesters. I'm going to troll you a little bit, Joe, just to remind listeners what the standard used to be for what British political leaders used to be willing to admit they were frightened of.
In 1984, the IRA blew up the Grand Hotel in Brighton. They killed five of Margaret Thatcher's friends and colleagues, and they very nearly killed her.
You hear about these atrocities, these bombs. You don't expect them to happen to you. But life must go on, as usual.
And your conference will go on.
Conference will go on, as usual.
Now, far be it from the popular show to hand anything to Margaret Thatcher, but she did walk out of a bombed out hotel and say she would continue giving her speech later that day. I can't imagine Reeves or Starmer doing that today. It's a different class of enemy, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. And hats off to that top trolling. I better be very careful what I say in response to that. But no, the advent of cry bullying, which is really a lot of what's going on and is the methodology of these kind of agro-centrist politicians, is really about, in many ways, the outrage that in any way, shape or form, they should be subjected to democratic accountability and political control. So again, let's think about Britgate and about what happened immediately afterwards. Again, I'm so sorry, David, to your American listeners for having to descend into such ridiculous minutiae. But again, I think James is right that we have to grapple with this because it's emblematic of a long history of agents provocateurs and false flag operations and confected stories that if you even talk about, you start to sound like a crank and a conspiracy theorist, which is part of how it works, right? But Angela Eagle went on to run a election challenge for the leadership that was abortive, and actually she had to give way to a man, although we didn't hear a lot about sort of middle class feminist outrage with regard to that at the time, because they were happy to unify behind the preposterous figure of Owen Smith. It was so preposterous, David, you won't even maybe have noticed this at the time, that he, in trying to appeal to Corbyn's base, imagined what they might like and said that what we really ought to be doing is negotiating with ISIS, which was just such a preposterous thing to have said that he, you know, and that was the flavor of the campaign that Angela Eagle herself had to get out of the way in favor of.
But I'd forgotten that. He was trying to appeal to us. He was trying to appeal to us.
So he's like, you guys are thugs, they're thugs. It's, you know, it's a bad match made in heaven.
The Owen Smith campaign was this farcical sort of precursor to the Starmer campaign. That's where it gets serious, right? They made so many flubs, but they did learn quickly. And the second time, they actually managed to pull it off. But on Eagle, she had launched this abortive campaign, but there was some trouble around the venue, which got cancelled, which then she claimed, or her office claimed, and again, in her office at this time was Imran Ahmed, who went on to form the Center for Countering Digital Hate. So again, you can start to join the dots on all these people and on this methodology. But we were told that that basically the venue had been intimidated out of hosting this event, this campaign launch, when it turns out that actually they just didn't know it was a political event and have a standing policy against all political events. So we were lied to again. But this was like all the lies point towards us as thugs, as the great unwashed, as rock throwers, as basically about to perform violence, right? Even though we've never actually done it.
And now, didn't Owen Smith also have an all-female short list? He did the binders full of women like Mitt Romney?
If I remember correctly. I may have blocked that out. You have to take care of your own mental health.
I don't know. Is there a more English word for binder?
The binders is...
Binders are binders.
Okay. Perfectly well. I think we all remember Romney for that. Romney actually looks like a towering statesman comparison with Owen Smith, who, by the way, tried to run to the left of Corbyn, failed, and then just went straight back to his job with Pfizer and the pharmaceutical industry out of which he'd emerged, if I recall correctly. Eagle, the underlying this, right, if you really look at it, the problem was that her constituency Labour Party was full of left-wingers that were organised. And so all of this then became evidence on which to suspend the constituency Labour Party to protect her from any kind of moves towards deselection, which at the time was seen as the worst sort of political crime that you could imagine if you listen to the centrist pundits and politicians. What that amounts to is basically being against primaries. In an American context, right? Mm. So if you think about how far insulated the Labour centrists want to be, even by comparison with their Democratic counterparts in the United States, where primaries happen all the time and it's just seen as part of the rough and tumble. And in fact, there's a great opportunity for fundraising from far-right billionaire donors that then has that money spent to knock out progressives in Democratic Party contests, right? So that, you know, that's rough and tumble, right? Not these completely confected stories that have no basis in evidence, but have become part of the lore by which this period is described, this aberration where the Hoi Polloi and the Great Unwashed took over and it was an electoral disaster, and we've now got to go back to being ruled by our betters, and absolutely do not question them when it comes to anything between elections, because you know that amounts to bullying and intimidation, and MPs ought to be above that.
So these are the pathologies of the currently resurgent centre. Meanwhile, we've got surprising far-right victories in Argentina and in the Netherlands in general elections this past week, with all polling pointing towards the Trump restoration next year. You've described this as a delusional moment for progressives and liberals, Joe. Can you give us an update in delusion, please?
Yeah, so the thinking about describing this period as a delusional moment is sort of twofold. And I think that plays out differently with regard to centrists than it does with regard to progressives, radicals, and the left. But I think both are at risk in different ways of a different kind of delusion that we need to face up to. Unfortunately, we're seeing, I think, now the beginnings of that kind of second great wave internationally of the populist far right surprise upset victories. But I would argue that throughout this period, actually, with a few exceptions, the Biden election being one of them, a lot more narrowly than we would have liked. But essentially, the most successful political force in the world today remains the populist far right. So we are losing, and we are losing badly. Where the delusion creeps in is that, you know, the dashboard warning lights for the likes of us have been blinking insistently for a long time. But finally, what we've seen is the beginnings of recognition of the systemic nature of the crisis, right? And when we first launched our Next System project back in 2015, that was a kind of bold proposition, that the idea that it was a systemic crisis. Now you get that from Janet Yellen at the Department of the Treasury. You get that from the OECD. You get it from IMF reports. This is is part of the recognition of the nature of the crisis. The problem is the gulf then between the recognition of that crisis and the proposals and policies and implementation that occurs. And I think, you know, I would have to say that I was at first pleasantly surprised by some of the things that came out of the Biden administration. I mean, if you just look at the American Rescue Plan, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, that's a great bit of trolling from Irish-American Biden of his counterparts in Britain. But in any case, these were big federal interventions, right? We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars. And yet, not only have they not made a difference politically in terms of the polling, and yes, all the things accepted, Joe Manchin blocked, you know, what could have been Build Back Better, and it could have been larger. But I think the difficulty, and this is where the delusion creeps in, is actually even the full-throated version of these liberal reform programs with enormous amounts of federal spending behind them simply aren't, you know, and will not bend the curve on the longstanding trends that we're up against, that I think certainly myself, and I think you would agree, are behind some of the forces and the dynamics that are producing this age of decay and of this sort of resurrection of neo-fascism. And the fact is that under Democrat and Republican alike, so-called good times and bad, if you look at the outcomes for ordinary Americans, they've been getting steadily worse in real terms across a whole slew of indicators. And we've looked at these at the Democracy Collaborative in detail. So we're talking about poverty, wealth inequality, racial wealth inequality, income inequality, wage stagnation, the cost of higher education and student loan debt, home ownership and the racial disparities that are involved in that, corporate taxation, taxation of the rich, union density, incarceration rates, including by race, labor force participation, although that one has begun to change a little bit recently under the heat and pressure of some of the Biden programs, but also changes in the American and global economy. But by and large, the trajectory of the system continues to be downwards. And what we're seeing with Bidenomics is the beginnings to start running slowly up that downward moving escalator. And the delusion comes from the sense that, oh, finally something's being done. Finally, we're mobilizing. Finally, the center is getting on board with understanding that we have to grapple with these trends. But the amazing gulf that still exists between the scale of the challenge that we're up against that's feeding climate collapse, but also the resurgence of the far right, dwarfs anything that is currently being countenanced and proposed. And on the left, it's slightly different, right? I think we had an agenda that, if you wanted to boil down Sanders and Corbynomics into one phrase, it was essentially the Green New Deal, right? It was a restructuring of the economy to deal with climate and inequality in a socially just fashion that would actually make sense and would manage capitalism better and even begin to transcend it at the edges, right? On its strongest version in Britain, I would say an even more diluted version of that, under Bernie. And I think the delusion that may be afflicting the left is that we too are not yet raising our sights to the full scale of what needs to be accomplished. So if you look at the original Green New Deal, the original New Deal that the Green New Deal is modeled after, actually, the New Deal didn't work. It was an enormously important intervention that was backed by Labour and by socialists and left liberals and communists and all sorts of others, social movements behind it and so on. But at its largest, it only amounted to 7% of GDP. It was World War II and the war economy that came in and the planning that underpinned that actually lifted the United States out of depression. And so we ourselves may have an insufficient historical analogy in terms of scale for what we're proposing. And then I think the further left you go, the more there is a tendency to see little projects or little models that prefigure the future as in some way being the significant work that we're doing when the overall trajectory of the system is down and down and down. And so that's the bleak delusion that I think that we are suffering from on multiple fronts and that really needs to be addressed by a politics that's capable of winning, or frankly, and this may be the answer, that is really about building lifeboats, which we may be getting towards in terms of whether we can win or not.
Do it's not tell tracking, Harvey J.K. Yeah. this.
Yeah, we never finished that conversation with Harvey J.K. about the New Deal, but I think this is a good impetus to do it. I was just going to say that it's very interesting to track the terminology around the versions of the Green New Deal that have been brought in-house by various governments. The EU was the first to drop the word new, thus distancing itself from the democratizing potential of the FDR reference. Starmer recently dropped the word green, such as his allergy to any kind of connection with anything progressive. So the British one's no longer green. The EU one isn't new. And I guess Biden's one isn't exactly a deal because there's so little buy-in for it overall. And he couldn't get the whole thing through. In the Corbyn period, these very kind of avant-garde economic ideas, these very progressive ideas for both macroeconomic strategy and also working in local government were brought in-house by the Labour Party, by John McDonnell. Is there anything comparable in the Democratic Party? You're there in Washington. Is there anyone in the Democratic Party who is listening to you guys at Democracy Collaborative?
I would say yes and no. And the no part is probably more important, which is the overall scale of what's needed isn't being reflected. And so what you're getting is occasionally a gesture in the direction of some of the economic democracy, democratizing the economy, democratizing capital strategies that were, frankly, that had found their way into Corbynomics, but that was the bare minimum that we needed, right? But that's been eroded. So what you do find is Biden officials or departing Biden officials saying things like, oh, we probably missed a trick by not taking equity stakes in some of the industry that we are basically de-risking and underwriting with public investment and so on, which, if you go back to the 1970s or is a sort of pale version of what the center was talking about in many ways there. So we have lost ground recently and we have lost ground historically. Where I think we are getting a hearing, and this is a strategic and structural challenge for us, is around the local bottom-up wealth building, community wealth building approaches, which have by their nature a kind of broad appeal, even to elements of the right of the political spectrum, local business people, people that are civically minded, people that are in the apparatus of the local and municipal state who recognize that they've tried everything else and it hasn't worked. So now they perhaps need to try some of these community wealth building democratic economy techniques. The danger there, and I'm going to actually be intervening on this, and TDC will, in both the UK and the US in the coming period, is around the notion that what you need to do is kind of add on a little bit of community wealth building on the side. You've got, by and large, a neoliberal regional or municipal economy, but it's not really delivering for sections of your base. You recognize that, and therefore let's add some community wealth building. Whereas I actually think what we need to be doing is sharpening the antagonism, where if you have a fundamentally extractive local economy built on financialization, on inflated land values, on returns to asset classes rather than production and consumption, then that by its nature is either going to displace and erode any progress that you make on community wealth building, or you've got to begin to displace and erode the power of that. And so we've got some research coming up on the UK and US economies over decades that actually shows the way in which financialization has occurred and its role as the locus of the new inequality, essentially, as we build what the authors of our report describe as a capital gains economy. So that's a long way of answering your question. I think there's an openness to the problem and a recognition that there aren't satisfactory answers. But when it comes to things that are actually being enacted, we are making some small wins. The CHIPS Act, which in some ways is a saber-rattling sort of geostrategic act of competition against China, does include, thanks to Congressman Jamal Bowman's office, an amendment that made them look at community wealth techniques around the technology hubs that they're putting regionally around the United States. We're going to see more cities coming on board with community wealth strategies. Some states are actually starting to entertain pieces. Drug pricing has gotten so outrageous and so monopolistic in the United States that essentially California now is threatening major moves and has them underway to engage in state production of pharmaceuticals, such that the insulin companies have already radically dropped their prices, which they told us wasn't possible, but as soon appeared the minute that there's the threat of a public option. So this is a wedge, a toehold, but again, we're kind of moving up that downward moving escalator that is accelerating us in terms of the trajectory of the overall system. And what's going to be left of all this stuff if Trump gets in, has a second term, with no prospect of either a third term under the Constitution, or maybe the Constitution gives
let's
way.
Say. Never say never.
Never say never. But you know, so these small wins aren't enough. They're not enough politically, and they don't stick if you suffer an immediate political reversal. And everything is so balanced on a knife edge that we can't rule that out.
This reminds me a lot of when Bloomberg did his cities initiative, and there was a lot of really interesting work done there. And of course, that I think that leaned a little bit into sort of hardening some of the neoliberal aspects of sort of community wealth building, washing some neoliberal projects. But the idea was that there were things that you could harden in the chance that there was another Trump administration. Here in Canada, we often have very local sort of projects like this. There's a company called Othello who does I'll put you in touch with the head of them as well. But they're finding that, you know, they're constantly fighting the big premiers, which are primarily conservative, it's not as conducive to lasting change, because as soon as something gets profitable for locals, people say, well, you know, we could make that really profitable for corporations.
It strikes me that talking about a delusional moment domestically, it also applies to foreign policy. I mean, that completely describes how Ukraine has played out. It's just, well, not exactly amazing, but I feel myself weeping for Zelensky for the first time in this whole ordeal, seeing how the guy has just been dropped. The guy has been told, time to wrap it up and compromise and decide what bits you're going to let go of. And I mean, you know, God knows how it's going to play out in Israel, but there almost seems to be a sort of a speedrun version of it. The elite opinion, elite media is not at all in control of these foreign policy narratives anymore in a way that I just haven't seen before. We really are seeing an ongoing breakup of the center, even in the moment of its apparent resurrection.
I mean, Ukraine really does make you weep. And again, to measure sort of the ground that's been lost in polite society around these things, one of the charges on the charge sheet against Henry Kissinger when Christopher Hitchens was in his earlier better phase and conducting the trial of Kissinger, mm-hmm. Was the deliberate sabotage around the Paris Peace Conference in the Vietnam War in 68 to make way for the Nixon administration. And of course, the intervening period involved tens of thousands of American combat deaths, let alone all the Vietnamese who died, largely for nothing, when a deal could easily have been reached in 68 if it hadn't been sabotaged. And so if you think about the role that the United States and NATO countries have played in essentially encouraging Ukraine to fight to the last Ukrainian, and where that is likely to end up in terms of an outcome that is far less favorable to Ukraine in terms of either its future prospects in the multilateral system or in terms of land acquisition, let alone the countless deaths of combat forces and civilians. It's an absolute travesty, and yet the people that were shouting the loudest in terms of treachery and so forth, when anyone dared to raise the concept of peace, and indeed under Starmer, a bunch of the Labour left signed on to the Stop the War letter on the Ukrainian conflict, and were forced to retract their signatures, and some of them even then were part of a conversation about whether we even should be abolishing Stop the War because it wasn't needed anymore. Yeah, well, yeah. How quickly
that was Corbyn advisors saying that.
How quickly that then turned around, and we've seen that actually we do need the infrastructure of a peace movement. And just the appalling things that are happening now in terms of the undermining of the so-called rules, of the so-called rules-based system, right? If you listen to Israeli government spokespeople talking about precedents for what they're doing in terms of the West has no room to talk to us about this, look at what you did in terms of the firebombing of Dresden or the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these were the very crimes against humanity that the Geneva Conventions and the post-war order was in recognition of. And even though obviously it was to some degree victor's justice at Nuremberg and Curtis LeMay and other people, including Arthur Bomber Harris of the RAF, should probably have been on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity as well. But of course, that didn't happen. At least there was an attempt to codify an international law and establish rules of the game that could then discipline what had essentially been this horrible seesaw, where in the 20th century, at the beginning of the century, if you look at conflict and war, the casualty sort of dispersal was something like 5% civilians versus 95% combatants at the beginning of the century. And that seesaw had completely swung by the end of the century to 95% civilian deaths in conflict and only 5% combatants. And so this is the stakes, right, that we're talking about here. And yet liberals, centrists, are happily burning down these rules. And they're not rules, by the way, if they only constrain the weak and never constrain the strong. And they certainly didn't apply in Fallujah and elsewhere In the bloody campaigns by the United States and its allies in recent years. But if this is what liberals and centrists are willing to countenance, just think what that far right, that again, let's emphasize, is the dominant and winning political force in the world today, is going to be thinking about and contemplating and enacting in a world of climate impacts, mass migration, economic destabilization, shortages, combat of, and conflict over water and food and so on. So I think this is a tremendously frightening set of developments. And essentially, this generation of liberals and centrists have nothing like the statecraft of the generation, whether it's FDR or Eisenhower or others, that at least could take the view of the system as a whole and at least recognize that there had to be some limits in the Cold War so that we didn't all incinerate each other in one giant conflagration at any point. That's not to minimize the disaster that befell so many regions and areas of proxy war and so on, but at least the pretense there was something to at least advocating for those principles, whereas now they're going straight out the window, and just think what that opens the door to in the future.
To just give a sort of sense of the spark of some thread of opportunity that still remains here, I mean, I've said elsewhere that part of what was exhilarating really about the 2016-2017 period was realizing one thing after another, how much people can change their minds. And we're actually, despite all the darkness, despite some of the worst things any of us have lived through going on right now, we're still seeing that. We're still seeing that that fluidity of opinion and that way in which you things that you thought people would never change their minds about, it is actually happening. And if I wanted one piece of evidence for that, it would be Norm Finkelstein, freed from his little apartment full of books, freed from a situation where the only people who will have him on are Chapo Trap House. And here he is on Piers Morgan's show. Let's just close with this remarkable clip.
Piers, I'm trying to be candid with you. Number one, I appreciate your humanity. I do. I don't know you from Adam. I'm not a TV or a television or a social media kind of person. I'm a book person. I'm old fashioned. However, I do recall that when that famous moment when Susan Boyle appeared on Britain's Got Talent, and I remember the camera turning to you, focusing on you. I could see it in my mind's eye. I saw your eyes narrow, and suddenly the humanity in you came up. Here is this obscure woman whose talent had gone unrecognized. And if I can speak to that same program, for me, the most poignant moment, the one I carry with me since that moment, was when Simon Cowell asked Susan Boyle, well, why haven't you been discovered yet? And she replied, because I haven't been given a chance. And that's how I feel about the people of Gaza. That's how I feel about those young men in Gaza. You ask me why I won't condemn them. Because those young men were born into a concentration camp.
This is the new environment we're in. Norm Finkelstein is telling Piers Morgan that he remembers when he teared up when Susan Boyle started singing. And this is the parable for the wasted opportunity and talents and beauty of the people of Gaza. In an information economy this unpredictable, Joe, we can't lose hope.
Well, absolutely. And I appreciate you for bringing us back around to this, right? When I was working on my book with Christine Berry on the Corbyn moment, People Get Ready, we were looking for epigraphs, and I tried to track down that famous phrase attributed to Raymond Williams about to be truly, truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. I actually found that he never said that. He almost said it on two occasions, but it's so good that I think we should let people put it on tea towels. And it's certainly a way to to be, because there's almost an ontological question that's arising for a lot of us as we see the system going down, as we try to be free of any delusions or illusions, as we look in a clear-eyed fashion at what's happening. And I just think it's the counterweight, the counterpoint at the moment is just the extraordinary flourishing of international networks of solidarity with Palestine that seems to be occurring on a scale and with a depth and immediacy and commitment and breadth that is unlike anything that we've seen in previous episodes, which of course matches the fact that the horrors that we're seeing are unlike previous episodes as well. And so I think we've got to take hope from that. If we look at opinion polls in the United States, in Britain, you see large majorities in favor of the human and humanitarian response of ceasefire. The pressure and the heat is on. Even if our elites, even those that we had looked to for leadership in the previous round, even as they're failing us, people are stepping up and stepping forward and being counted. And I think if there's any thing that I live by as the sort of bottom commandment, it's absolutely never give up, even if it means going down fighting. And I think that's what that's the position that the left is in at the moment. We are nowhere near power. We are nowhere near affecting the world that we need to bring into being. But the challenges that are facing us are so of such a magnitude and touch everybody in a sense that there's a chance of us rediscovering the universalism of some of the truths that we hold dearest and getting beyond some of the nonsense that I would say this show has been very important on parsing and sifting. So let's absolutely make hope possible rather than despair convincing, never give up the fight and build those bonds of comradeship and solidarity that ultimately are what's needed for the ultimate solution, which is the largest democratic movement the world has ever seen. There's no other way. There's no shortcuts. There's no royal road. Nothing but a democratic revolution around the world is actually going to save us from the threats that we're facing as a civilization and as a planet now.
Well, let's raise a Thanksgiving.
1:05. Oh yeah. I want that uh-huh. in a clip. That was so good.
That's the Thanksgiving message.
I was getting a little hungry for lunch, and I was like, and the adrenaline kicked in, and I felt pretty good. So thank you, Joe. That really pumped me up.
That's what we go back to Joe for.
It's great.
Patreon.com/thepopularpod if you want to help us out. Joe Guinan, it is always an honor and, as David says, an exhilaration to speak to you. Keep it up, man.
Let's try and win a little between now and when we meet next time. That's what
winning feels good. That's what I always tell people. Winning feels good.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be with you, comrades.
Thank you.